Today on Against the Grain, we often hear how poorly educated American students are, ill-prepared for 21st century tech jobs which go to other workers in other countries. But what if, as my guest today argues, more education will not lead to more highly paid skilled jobs? I'm Sasha Lilly, educational psychologist Gerald Coles joins me to talk about how American companies are in fact getting the workers they need, since most of the economy is based on low-paid jobs. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We know that America is a vastly unequal society and that many people languish in low-paid jobs. Experts tell us that for there to be more high-skilled, highly paid jobs in the United States, the schools need to produce kids who've been educated in science, technology, engineering, and math. But does that argument hold water? In Miseducating for the Global Economy, How Corporate Power Damages Education and Subverts Students' Futures, published by Monthly Review Press, Gerald Coles writes that it's based on a misleading understanding of how American capitalism works. Coles is an educational psychologist whose work focuses on literacy, learning disabilities, and the politics of education. He was on the faculty at the Department of Psychiatry at Rutgers and the Department of Education and Human Development at the University of Rochester. Jerry, we're told that one of the key reasons that there are low-paid jobs in the U.S. is because American public schools don't give kids the 21st century education they need for highly skilled jobs, and hence the jobs go elsewhere. Is there any validity to this claim?
Essentially, no. The percentage of high-skilled jobs today, which is anywhere from 10 to 15 or so percent of all jobs, hasn't changed over many years. In the 1950s, it was about 15%. Now it's a little higher. But the key thing in terms with respect to employment as a whole is that the kind of jobs that are both substantial in number and show then projections show will increase are jobs such as salespersons, cashiers, food preparation, service workers, customer service representatives, waiters, waitresses, et cetera, labor, freight stock. So the majority of jobs that are that exist and are continue to be projected as jobs that will comprise the majority of the economy of work takes up the largest percentage of current jobs and future projections. So the answer is no. Now, of course, it's true that with any particular person in school or any family looking to provide the best future for the occupational future for their child, getting more education will increase the prospect of getting a good paying job and a more secure job. But the worst nightmare for corporate America would be if everybody graduating from high school and college had STEMs, scientific, technical, engineering, mathematical, high school job education. There would be no jobs for them.
Because you're saying that would lead to a glut of overskilled workers for an economy in which most of it is not skilled.
Right. Yeah. Most of it is minimum skilled. Right. The only exception to that, which in projection of growing number of jobs, is nurses. Registered nurses are the only large occupation group that will require advanced education.
But couldn't advocates of this notion that America needs more highly skilled students to come out of the public school system to have, therefore, more high-tech jobs, better paid jobs in the U.S. economy, wouldn't they make the counter-argument that, well, if there were more workers who were trained to be more skilled, then perhaps the percentage of high-tech or high-skilled jobs in the U.S. would shift?
There's no evidence from any studies that I have that I discuss in my book that have been done by corporate organizations to indicate that businesses are holding back on the number of high-skilled jobs that they could create because there aren't enough workers for them. Every study that has been done, whether it's from the Rand Corporation onward, has concluded that there are more than enough workers, skilled workers, for the skilled jobs that are available. Now, it's true that if you do any kind of survey today, tomorrow, the next day, of the skilled jobs that are available and the vacancies among those jobs, you will find that that is a problem for businesses. But it's always been a problem. It's always a problem for businesses. That is to say, there are always openings at any given time because you're looking to hire somebody who will fit the bill. And so when there have been openings, when there are openings in the country for jobs, the research shows that the openings are primarily, A, because they're not paying enough people. There was a Rand study pointed out that if you're trying to get a skilled worker to work for less money, that's not evidence of a skill crisis. Secondly, there's a problem of just of geography. That is, there are jobs that are open, but people who are skilled to do those jobs are reluctant to move because they're not sure how secure those jobs would be, and moving would be a huge problematic issue for them. So essentially, the answer is no. Businesses are creating the skilled jobs that they need, and there's no problem overall in getting skilled workers to do those jobs. What's really going on, and this is what I develop at length in my book, what's really going on is that you have an economy in which the majority of jobs, even with the increased number of employed people today in the last year or so, where the majority of jobs are not high-paying jobs, the few benefits, they're insecure, et cetera, and so for large numbers of people in the United States, you have employment that doesn't meet their daily their basic needs, and if they're married or have families, certainly doesn't meet their family needs. And so, what do you do? You wind up blaming the schools for the lack of secure and sufficiently remunerative employment for people. That's essentially what's going on in terms of occupation. But there's a whole other dimension to all of this, and that dimension has to do with the nature of education itself. What's been critical for, actually since the 60s and certainly beginning in the 70s for almost half a century now, is that there has been a relentless effort to narrow the curriculum, to provide an education in which children are not critical thinkers, in which the qualities of philosopher Cornel West, talking about education, talked about an education that develops a sense of compassion, of justice, of empathy, of critical view of the world around us. So since the free school movement in the mid-60s, there has been a conflict between educators and parents who have tried to create an education that is a more critical, inclusive, cooperative education. And on the other side, you've had businesses and political institutions that represent those businesses attempt to narrow the range of education, to reduce critical thinking, reduce cooperative learning, and so forth. And that's been expressed in a variety of ways, not simply in terms of the curriculum overall, that is in terms of what history books and so forth are used, how students and how teachers engage students and organize learning in the classroom, but right down to literacy instruction. Literacy instruction has been a kind of Trojan horse that has served to narrow the range of engagement and understanding of students.
And what do you think has driven that push since the 1970s by corporate interests to narrow education further and further? Because certainly this goes counter to the narrative that is coming from a lot of these corporations, since a lot of them fund educational initiatives and so on, that skills are needed, even critical thinkers are needed. So what has been the main impetus for this push for narrowing of education by those in the elite?
That's a good question. So I would say that there are at least two parts to it. One part is that the concept of critical thinking has been and is a growing concept in education. But the meaning of critical thinking is thinking around the production of products, services, thinking within business needs and within the role that your particular occupation slot provides. So critical thinking is related how to make another better iPhone, which of course does involve critical thinking, but not the critical thinking that looks at the meaning of our democracy, equity, and so on and so forth. And so with relationship to that, the attack on critical thinking can actually be in terms of what happens in the society, what happens in the economy, the equity, justice, cooperation, people's need, genuine needs, and so forth, can be traced back to a document, 1975, that was published by the Trilateral Commission, which was an organization of business leaders and various academics and political representatives. And the remarkable statement in that Trilateral Commission of 1975 is that there's been an excess of democracy. That's actually the term that was used. And the excess of democracy has had to do not only with the anti-war movement of the 60s and early 70s, but also had to do with the various openings in classroom instruction that looked more closely at the world, at justice, war, well-being, the allocation of resources, and so forth. Essentially, what had been developed in the free schools, then what became open classrooms, and then started to emerge in something that was called whole language, which really had to do with the opening of thinking and the engagement of the world, rather than just the narrow literacy method. So what you have, so there are two parts to what I would term the assault on education is comprised of. One is to make it increasingly vocationally oriented, narrowing it. Secondly, to diminish the various parts of the curriculum that serve to create whole thinking, critical, caring people.
I'm speaking with educational psychologist Gerald Coles. He is the author of Miseducating for the Global Economy. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, why is reading, why has reading been such a battleground politically? What are the stakes in the emphasis on reading and from various national policies and the implications for a child's learning and larger engagement with the world?
Reading is, from the beginning of education, serves as a kind of homunculus for the rest of the curriculum. It serves to organize the classroom, what students think about, how they are engaged, and so forth. And the constriction of thinking begins in early literacy education with the insistence that literacy education needs to focus on skills, narrow skills, phonemic skills, and it needs to be heavily guided by a teacher. And the curriculum from that point on is in grammar school is centered first around the control of literacy learning and literacy engagement. So in the past and up until the present time, you have manufactured textbooks that have particular stories in them, particular skills in them, particular questions in them. They're very much teacher-led. I taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade at one point in my early adult years, and I was given a set of textbooks that were totally prescriptive, and there was very little opportunity in the classroom to engage students in anything laterally outside of those books. And the instruction that emerges from the use of that kind of prefabricated material is one in which the teacher is the authority, the students follow the authority crafts, they answer questions that the authority presents, they engage in projects that the textbook advocates, and there's essentially a student as learning object paradigm that this method of teaching nurtures, which is very different from an approach in which students have opportunities to choose what they want to read, in which they work together in groups, in which they think about what they're reading and then extend that reading to various projects. That could be anything from a community project to a scientific project. They're subjects. There's a nurturing of students as subjects in the world rather than as objects, to quote a Brazilian educator, Paulo Freire, they're as containers to be filled. So it's a very different approach, and And the business leaders and political advocates for these leaders have and educators who have been associated with them have worked very hard over the last 50 years to create an education in which you create students who have who acquire the qualities that you want workers to acquire, which is largely obedient and thinking within the realm of within the boundaries in which creative thinking, comprehension of issues are limited.
Gerald Coles is my guest. He's an educational psychologist and the author of Miseducating for the Global Economy. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're describing a situation in which the curriculum is getting narrower and narrower. So things like arts are being jettisoned, social studies reduced, music jettisoned, and then all of this emphasis on reading and about science, technology, engineering, and math, frequently referred to as STEM. Can you tell us about the ways that corporations have been involved in funding specific initiatives to do with science, technology, engineering, and math education, and what these sorts of initiatives show us about these efforts?
Sure. Yeah, there's been an increase in corporate intrusion in the schools where corporations have developed organizations that STEM learning organizations that purportedly are aimed at promoting STEM education in schools and providing additional resources for schools to better educate students for the so-called 21st century economy. And what I document is that when you look at these organizations, for example, there's one called Project Lead the Way, which is a corporate organization comprised of companies like Chevron, Dow, Lockheed Martin, ExxonMobil, and so on and so forth. What they do is provide schools for schools, it's a fair amount of money, but in terms of corporations, it's peanuts. What they do is provide funds that create various kinds of STEM learning, both for students and for teachers. However, what is left out of all of this learning, primarily because you don't want to, students don't want to bite the hands that feed them, is any kind of understanding of what the STEM production in these corporations have done in communities and various nations. So, as I explain in the book, if you look at either Project Lead the Way or other similar STEM organizations, if you look at the role that these organizations have played, you find in Dow, for example, vast pollution of communities both here and elsewhere. You find Lockheed Martin cheating American taxpayers out of millions of dollars by manipulating the funding that they get through federal grants to create weaponry. Of course, with a company like ExxonMobil, you have vast oil spills, which have damaged waterways, coastlines, et cetera, et cetera. And so what you have in all of these corporate programs is an implicit method or assurance that students will look solely at the narrow definition of STEM, but never look closely or at all about what these STEM companies are doing to the world. What you have that makes the intrusion of these corporations so welcome is the reduction of tax contributions by these same corporations, which in turn means reduced school funding. So with fewer school funds, of course, schools are going to welcome any kind of additional money that they can get. And as I point out in the book, which I think really underscores the heinousness of all of this, is that imagine a school considering hiring teachers who had been convicted of pollution, of home evictions, of job losses, community health problems, and even deaths. What school would ever hire anybody with that kind of background? But with respect to these corporations that offer a small amount of money from their perspective to come in and become dominant forces in the schools welcome them, and there's not a word said, any kind of curriculum explanation about what the nature of these STEM corporations are all about and what they do in the world.
And isn't also there the component, in some cases, of more directly crass material benefit here in the San Francisco Bay Area? Various schools are given Chromebooks, which may be seen as a boon to those schools, but in fact gets the products into the hands of young people, perhaps with the intention of having them using and buying those products when they're older.
Well, that's a good point. Sure, yeah, there's certainly that, and there's certainly the way in which something like a Chromebook becomes a repository for what the world is about, that in terms of STEM jobs, in terms of technology being important, and so forth. What I wanted to add to this is that it's very important in discussing all of this to underscore that from the point of view of American businesses, American schools do a splendid job in providing the workers that various businesses need, which is not the same as providing what the students as students and adults need. But you have an economy with an array of employment, and the schools do an excellent job, as they have in the past with respect to tracking, do an excellent job of providing providing workers with various levels of competence that are required. And it's easy to see in a place like Rochester, where you have youngsters in suburban communities with schools that have all that that schools need. You have teachers who are getting decent salaries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then a place like Rochester, where I live, where poverty level is very, very high, where schools are underfunded, et cetera, et cetera. So the schools in these respective communities turn out youngsters and then adults with different levels of employment abilities. But that works for the economy as a whole. If I could just go back to one point, one historical point, which is essential in understanding what's going on today. As we said when we started the show, the percentage of STEM workers is approximately 15 or so percent. That's projected over the next 10 years or so. It might hit 20%. In the 1950s, the high-skilled work was approximately 15%. However, that was a time that that's the time that Trump points to as a time when America was great and wants to make America great again by going back to that time. Well, if he were to make America great again, what he would want to do and what Americans would want to do is to recreate the organization of labor that produced jobs in manufacturing, for example, that economist Robert Reich estimates was $35 an hour. I'm going to tell you a personal story about myself in a second with regard to that. So you had what you had at a time when jobs were when employment paid a lot more than it pays now. Manufacturing jobs now are anywhere from $11 to $15 an hour, very commonly. So what you had at that time was workers, was unions that represented more than a third of workers, and unions pressing for higher wages and benefits and obtaining them. And with the decline in wages, again, you have the blaming of individuals for their low wages, blaming it on their skills, rather than on companies being able, because there's less organized labor, to pay people a lot less. I just want to say that I know this from personal experience because I'm old enough to have worked when I finished high school. I went to work in Buffalo for Chevrolet. My father was hardly employable, and I contributed a great deal to the upkeep of the family. So as a kid out of high school, I was making, in today's dollars, $27 an hour. Did I have skills? No, I didn't have skills, but I had the United Auto Workers who negotiated with General Motors to get me a very decent wage.
Sure.
And yeah, so that entire issue of labor power and what companies can pay and are no longer forced to pay is something that's totally excluded in the name of we have a skilled economy and you have to get skilled. Skills if you want to have a decent life, et cetera.
Indeed. I'm speaking with educational psychologist Gerald Coles. We'll return with him in a moment. Thank you. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm joined by Gerald Coles, who is the author of Miseducating the Global Economy. That's published by Monthly Review Press, and you can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's an educational psychologist whose work focuses on literacy, learning disabilities, and the politics of education, and he was on the faculty of the Department of Psychiatry at Rutgers and the Department of Education and Human Development at the University of Rochester. And we're talking about the argument that for there to be high-skilled, highly paid jobs in the United States, that the public schools have to produce kids who have been educated in science, technology, engineering, and math. I wanted to ask you, Jerry, about the push toward digital learning and where this fits in both what you have argued is the narrowing of education since the 70s, but also this corporate push to, at least ostensibly, create a workforce that has the appropriate skills for the economy.
In my book, I discuss some of the new forms of digital learning where students are able to go to their computers and open up a course on social studies, science, etc., at any time, day or night. They can take independent courses and so forth. And the courses are very well organized, unlike teaching in a classroom. If you don't get it right the first time in digital learning, you can do it over again and get it right so that it's a really a highly polished, finished product for students to maximize their ability to learn. The problem with the development of digital learning with respect to developing students' thinking about how the world works, how they fit into it, and what the values they should acquire in being a thinking, caring person in the world is that the digital learning is essentially the content of digital learning is essentially the same content that has been promoted by the corporate intrusion in the classroom of limiting what students think about, how they understand the world, and so on and so forth. And so, and I have some examples in the book where the misconceptions of power, of democracy, of caring, and so forth, are similarly conveyed in digital learning as they are in any kind of classroom that provides this kind of narrow education. So if you look, for example, at what is or isn't included in textbooks with respect to American Revolution, slavery, labor in the global economy, who profits in the global from labor in the global economy, the amount of child labor in the global economy. All of that which is absent for a large part in classrooms is similarly absent in digital learning. You basically simply have a more sophisticated container providing the same content.
I want to ask you about something you mentioned earlier on, which is in the push to narrow learning, you said there's also a countervailing force, which has been teachers, parents who have tried to push things in a different direction. And you mentioned free schools. What were they, and where did those efforts lead?
So free schools, which developed in the 60s, were primarily, not totally, but primarily intended to be outside of standard education and to develop curricula and methods of learning that were going, that were successful, that would fulfill a variety of ends, but be models that could then be incorporated into public schools. There were some exceptions where there were very affluent communities that wanted free schools that were basically going to be well-funded private schools that would ensure the future occupational, et cetera, success of their kids. But for the most part, the schools were the free schools were not that. For the most part, the free schools in the 60s were alternatives that explored issues such as peace, poverty, equality, culture, gender, community, power, war, etc. And they were intended to also make students caring, active agents in the world. Their educators published a number of books that that reflect that. You have Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Compulsory Miseducation, The Open Classroom, et cetera, that reflected the effort to create a different kind of education. In some cases, the education was too freewheeling, and there was a question of whether there certainly was a certainty that teachers needed to be more engaged in the learning process, with students having too much say in what their education was going to be, and so it turned out to not be very effective. So there was a lot that was going on, but essentially the free school education was meant to create students who cared about what was going on and went beyond the ideological boundaries of standardized education. And the result of that was a pushback on the part of politicians, business people, and educators who felt that students needed to be, to use a phrase from another book of the time, they need to be schooled to order. And there was too much of an array of opportunity for thinking that was going to be harmful to the society. The way that was responded to on part of corporate America and its agents was not by saying, well, there's too much thinking going on, or to use the quote that I had a little while ago, an excess of democracy. But what the response was that students were not learning, that the free schools and all kinds of alternatives were bad because they were unsuccessful. As I traced the actual empirical evidence of that claim that students didn't do as well in reading and math, et cetera, as they did in conventional schools, in conventional classrooms, and it turns out not to be true. That the students in the alternative schools, free schools, open classrooms, didn't do better on the tests, on the research that use standardized reading tests, but they didn't do any worse. There was essentially, within terms of conventional standards of reading, math, and so forth, they did about the same. So in terms of the schools, the alternative schools providing a worse education by standardized measures, that wasn't true. But what was true is that they were creating different kind of students, and that was not a good thing for people who have power, dominant power in this country.
Well, reflecting on that, the experience of the free schools, the backlash to it, and the attempts of people since the 60s to reform education in ways that would be progressive and even liberatory, what do you conclude about the limits of progressive educational reform?
Well, I would say in terms of limits, I think that we can certainly can and should expand the limits. In terms of doing that, what's essential is for educational organizations to begin to expand their pushback. Basically, what you have in the American Federation of Teachers, National Education Organization, Association, and other educational groups is a pushback solely in terms of the ways in which education has been so sorely constricted, in terms of teacher salaries, in terms of the reduction of funds for schools, and so forth. And what is necessary is to begin to is for these organizations and teachers' unions to begin to develop a conversation and an explanation that begins to address, A, in terms of corporate needs, the American schools serve corporate needs very well, and B, corporations calculatingly underfund and miseducate students because that fits well provides answers to their array of needs. And what's needed is to begin a conversation and attempt to develop educational alternatives that explore what this world is about, what the economy is about, people's needs are, what damage the powers that shape education also do to the world, is to begin to create an alternative conversation, an alternative vision to what the world should be and what schools should be in relationship to that alternative vision. Fortunately, today, in doing so, there is the essential need to use the what had been the word that dared not be uttered. That is the word capitalism. You have, fortunately, today an increased open critique of capitalism, of large numbers of people feeling. Expressing a desire for a more socialistic country, and so the opportunity is ripe to begin to open a conversation about education that has to do with the way education fits into the larger political economy. unless we begin to do that, it's going to be impossible to begin to talk about crafting a different education that goes beyond narrowly serving the serving the narrow needs of corporations and serving as an institution that gets blamed for the consequential problematic lives of many people.
We're totally out of time. I've been speaking with the author of Miseducating for the Global Economy. His name is Gerald Coles. He's an educational psychologist. His other books include Reading Lessons. And Miseducating for the Global Economy is published by Monthly Review of Press. If you go to againstthegrain.org, you can find a link. Jerry, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Thank you.